Welcome back to Building Better Basketball, the Basketball Australia Coaches Podcast. I'm Neil Gray, the Community Capability and Education Manager for Basketball Australia. I'm joined today by someone who fills a vital role in sport, which is uncommon in basketball currently, but on the rise. A three-time WNCL winning support staff member, a soon-to-be, hopefully, one-time Sheffield Shield winning staff member, Emma Doherty is the Player Development Manager for Cricket Tasmania. And she's going to share with us some insight about her role and hopefully give you some ideas about areas we could investigate in basketball. Emma, thank you for giving up your time and welcome to Building Better Basketball.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Emma, like I said, your role isn't very common in basketball, but as the listeners might have noticed, we have a position that's being advertised to bring this in nationally from BA's perspective. Can you give the listeners a bit of a, I guess, elevator pitch example of what your job description is?
Honestly, if I got a dollar for every time I'd been asked what my job is, I would be a very, very rich lady. Essentially, my role is to look after the player as a person and everything outside of what happens on the field. So health and well-being, any sort of education and training or personal development, career development that they are interested in, getting them involved in the community. And then there's also an element of helping to build team culture and the values and behaviours that we live by within the group.
How, within that environment, and you're operating, for those that aren't familiar with cricket, Emma's working with the athletes who are in the Tassie Tigers women's team, which is, like I said, three-time champions, the men's Tasmanian Tigers team, which is in the Sheffield Shield final, and the Hobart Hurricanes, which is obviously the BBL, both male and female. So you're operating at like elite level players and players that are both international for Australia and other countries. How do you balance the development of what you said there, personal skills, the cricket part of it, the health, and then their well-being and development with that, obviously, expectation of performance?
It is really challenging, especially in the male game, which I've come to learn in the last sort of 9 months since I've been involved with the boys. They earn a lot more cash, and so it's even harder to get them to think about things outside of cricket. They've got this perception that there's not time to do anything else outside of cricket, but when I sit down with them, they usually figure out that actually there's lots of time for them to do other things. In terms of personal skills and development, my biggest message to the players is to do something bite-sized, you know, something that doesn't require a lot of commitment and time but can have huge reward for them. So my go-to is usually have a coffee with someone that you admire and just have a chat. And who knows what will come from that. And in terms of the well-being and health side of things, athletes these days they're getting more and more educated in that space. And in cricket, we're incredibly blessed in terms of the resourcing that players have access to. And I understand that's probably not the same in all other sports, but our guys and girls are really lucky. So if they're willing to invest, there's the help there. In saying that, athletes, as we know, are often perfectionistic and workaholics, and so that can throw a bit of a spanner in the works when we're trying to get them to focus on their well-being. Something that I've been working really hard on, especially in the female group over the last little while, is self-compassion. And for athletes, that's a really fluffy concept. But once you bust a few of the myths and provide them with a bit of evidence, they generally start to buy in on some level and understand that, you know, there's time to be a perfectionist and a workaholic and stuff like that, but there's also lots of times where that's not actually going to be helpful. So investing in being kind to yourself is really important.
I think that's, again, like I say this, I think every episode, like Emma's obviously talking there about players, but there's obviously lots of things that our listeners as coaches can take away and reflect on what they're doing for themselves as well, because coaches tend to be workaholics even more so than players.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's often the cohort that gets in cricket, it gets missed. You know, there's every support under the sun for our players, but actually the coaches are the ones driving the program. They're the ones that when the players aren't at training, they're planning the training sessions. So they need to invest in their well-being, I would say, arguably probably more than players, just to be the best version of themselves for their players, you know, and for their families at home and stuff as well. So, yeah, it's an even harder sell to the coaches, that self-compassion piece. I usually try and go down the route of, you know, you need to lead by example here. I need you to role model this behavior. And, you know, some are better at it than others.
Emma, you obviously are filling a number of different kind of societal roles for these players, in some terms a confidant, in some teams like a mentor, a teacher, friend. Obviously, the most important part of that is obviously having them trust you, and by extension also having the coaches trust you, because you're going to be potentially hearing some things that they won't hear. And then there's all the other stakeholders that kind of come off of that. How do you, and can you discuss the importance of building those trusted relationships to foster the environment of support for the player?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I learned really early on in this role that if the players and coaches don't trust you as a player development manager, you actually can't do your job. You're not setting yourself up for success. It's at the core of what we do. And for me, everything comes back to the strength of the relationship you have with those people and those stakeholders. From a player's point of view, it allows them to feel comfortable in sort of letting you in and sharing their worries and vulnerabilities, which sometimes you're the only person that they've told that to. I've been in a lot of situations where someone is speaking to me about something that they've never spoken to anyone else about. And it can be a really tricky position to be in, but what a privilege to be able to be that person for the athlete. And if you don't have that trust with them, they're definitely not going to come to you. On the other hand, something that I've learned probably more recently as I've become more experienced in the role is that strong foundation can really be leveraged to challenge as well. So for a long time, I really I took pride in the relationships that I had with the players, but I didn't want to affect them. But what I've realized is once the foundation is there, you can basically do anything, challenge, you know, have some hard conversations, and they'll still come back. You know, you don't lose them. So yeah, I guess it's kind of twofold in that the strong relationship allows them to come to you with any concerns, but also for you to be able to challenge them to be the best versions of themselves as well, which is really important. In terms of that same relationship with coaches, again, I've been lucky enough to have coaches that have been really supportive of the player development space. And so I've kind of, that's a massive enabler for what we do, is to have the coach on board with our area of expertise and what we do. But I have seen it a number of times where that's not the case, and potentially coaches feel as though the player development might negatively impact performance by trying to get players to think about things outside of cricket and to prioritize their well-being and all that kind of stuff. But we know now that actually that's completely the opposite, that if you've got a balanced athlete who feels comfortable and safe in their environment and who don't have all their eggs in the cricket basket or the basketball basket, they're actually, that's really conducive to performance. So having that relationship and earning the respect of the coach is really, really important. And then I guess the wider business too. Oftentimes we get caught up in sport, like sport is a business, especially at the elite level, and people that operate outside of the high performance environment sometimes can perceive the athletes to be just the product that produces the profit, whereas actually they're humans first. And so something that I've worked really hard on is to try and build relationships with sort of all the business units here at Cricket Tas and bring them on the journey, on the player's journey, and provide opportunity for interaction with, you know, staff coming to training sessions and that kind of thing, just to really, I guess, show them why they're here. You know, we're a cricket organisation, we're here for cricket, and they play a role in it, directly or indirectly. but these players are people. So yeah, I mean, relationships, people get sick of me talking about it because it is actually the most important thing in this role.
So I've been lucky enough to coach, I think, probably three or four of the players that are in the Tassie Tigers WNCL. And I know that when they have a relationship that of someone that they trust, that they kind of hold that really dear, and it's part of the culture that they've taken with them to Tassie, and that's mm-hmm. built the Tassie culture. And I think a lot of that comes down to people like yourself within the Tigers system, where they're able to handle both professional issues that those players have and personal issues confidentially, and obviously to the high level of professionalism. What strategies do you employ to create that safe space for the players to reach out to you to seek guidance, so you don't have to be the one that goes to them?
I think for me, and it's different for everybody, strategies are different for everybody. I like authenticity and being incredibly genuine is something that I really pride myself on. And I think that I've found that the more relatable you are to the players, the more likely they are to come to you, and the quicker the relationship will sort of strengthen. So for me, it's just been just treating them all as individuals and really understanding who they are at their core. So, you know, just being interested and curious about who they are and how they operate. And you know yourself, when someone's really interested in you, it makes you feel good, and it makes you feel like you can trust them and that they're someone that you can confide in and, you know, spitball ideas with or have a vent with or whatever it might be. So for me, it's just been about being my genuine self. And, you know, yes, I do have a title as player development manager, and I take that professional side really seriously. But in the early stages, at least, like, you need to just be human, and they need to understand that, because it's a different relationship, I think, than a player coach relationship. Obviously, the coaches are in charge of, they're doing the hiring and the firing and the selecting and all that kind of stuff. And so it's hard for a coach to have the same relationship with a player as a player development manager does. I mean, not to say that, like, we've got some players that have got really, all of our players have got great relationships with our coaches, but it's different. The confidentiality piece can also be tricky, because, you know, if I do have a player come to me, or if I notice, that's the other thing, if you know your players well enough and they're not ready to come to you, you can approach them and have the conversation around, you know, this is what I've noticed. And most of the time they'll open up. If they're not ready, that's okay. You just have another crack at another time. But coaches aren't stupid. They sense when stuff is happening with their players, and they generally want to know what's going on. And that's mostly, I think, out of concern in my experience. Like, there's a little bit of that coach's control potentially. Like, they just want to know what's going on with everything. And you can understand that because it's their program. But juggling that sort of, you know, when a player comes and divulges something and it's not impacting their ability really to train, and they're not missing anything from the program, but they don't want anyone to know, that can be quite challenging to navigate. But I think what I've learned over the time is it's my role to support and protect the player first. And that's where the relationship with the coach is really, really important. If they trust you to do your job, then they won't ask a million questions. All they want to know is if the player's okay and if they're getting the help that they need.
With that word, we'll carry that word help through. So we've seen it in a number of sports, and it's prevalent in society, and it's becoming more and more widely spoken about at the elite level, and also a lot more understanding about it at the kind of community level and the range in between. How do you, I guess, work in the role of psychologists and mental health professionals and supporting the players' well-being, if that ends up being a requirement for them?
I've seen lots of different models of resourcing with psychology in cricket. It's vital. Like you say, it's out there in society. Everybody's talking about it pre-COVID, but especially post-COVID. We have gone from a model where we had just a clinical psychologist that was available to all of our players. here at Cricket Tasmania to going to a model where everything was external. So the players, there was nobody on site, and players just saw individuals of their choice outside of the environment, to now having a performance psychologist here on site 4 days a week. And then he sort of refers out for clinical issues. And that's the model that's been working the best for us, because rightly or wrongly, players in my experience seem to want to separate their what they perceive as a performance psychology issue and something that's clinical. Realistically, we know that they're all linked and stuff like that. But purely for engagement purposes, having the performance side of things looked after by someone and then giving the player choice with anything sort of clinical has worked really, really well. And we're starting to see the female program here at Cricket Tas, they're like sponges. They're happy to take on anything, any resource available to them. They'll figure out how they can use that. So watching the growth there in sort of engagement in psychology has been incredible. We're not quite there with the male program. And I think that's, we've got a lot of historical, I guess, not trauma, but, you know, like old school players have an impact and a ripple effect for a really long time. So we're trying really hard to shift that mindset here at Cricket Tas. And we are, you know, we're making small gains, you know, as time goes by in terms of engagement from the boys. But as a player development manager, having a psychologist on staff and someone that you can go to is incredibly helpful, especially when it gets to the pointy end. And it does, you know, you have mental health crises and, you know, that's outside my scope. So I can only manage that situation to a certain point, and then I need to refer that to the experts, and knowing that I've got that person there is, oh, it's a godsend.
So often, sometimes those mental health crises will have a root sometimes in something totally unrelated to cricket, but sometimes there'll be something to do with non-selection, transition, retirement, injury. And that's something that's consistent across all sport, both professional and amateur, the effect of doing an ACL at any level, for example. And I know, for example, within the Tasmanian program, you have a player that's done an ACL in consecutive seasons, which is a significant mental health hurdle to overcome. How do you support the players during that example of a double injury back to back, or someone transitioning out of cricket or being dropped?
I think transitions are always really challenging. It doesn't matter what they are, whether it's transitioning in as a young person, transitioning out, you know, being dropped and having a form slump. In terms of, the back-to-back ACLs, that was horrendous. But something that we, a strategy that we use down here is holistic case management. So, you know, you look at that injury, you know that player's going to be not playing cricket for 12 months. It's physical in the acute stages, but it becomes more about their well-being and their mental health the longer the injury goes on. So usually I'm the case manager for that situation, where we always have the player at the core and they're in charge of, you know, how they want things to play out and how they want things to be during their recovery. But, you know, I'll pull together a team of people depending on the injury. For example, with that ACL, we obviously have physio, strength and conditioning coach. The player had a pre-existing relationship with the psychologist, so we brought the psychologist in as well. And in those initial phases, we didn't have the head coach in there, just because, you know, the player's not doing any skills. They would catch up with the player outside of that just to check on their well-being. But, yeah, just a really holistic case management approach, so that every facet of the player is being supported through that time. Non-selection and retirement are sort of a little bit different. I think the non-selection piece is always a conversation around, especially if it's the first time. Players tend to, it's always hard, but they tend to understand what their resilience strategies are the more they experience it. But initially it's that conversation around, you know, what can you control in this situation, and just really getting a plan going forward. So they're usually conversations with myself, the head coach, psychologist, if the player wants to. The retirement one is always, we've got one this year actually, one of the boys has just retired, and it's always a nice conversation in terms of they've been given the privilege to choose to end their career, which doesn't happen for everyone. So that's probably my favorite transition is the retirement, because, you know, it's a warm and fuzzy. Yeah, it's difficult, absolutely. The work for me comes in after that, you know, in the 6 to 12 months post, and it's supporting them into the big wide world and, yeah, making sure that their life after cricket is set up for success.
So with that, again, leading you, you're a pro at this, Emma, you lead every question on to the next one. You've got players, obviously, that are at the kind of crux of leaving school and coming into professional play. So yep. Obviously, I know, especially in the women's program, you've in the last couple of years had a couple of 16 and 17 year olds come into your program who are balancing school and trying to be a professional athlete. And then you have players that potentially left school at 16, started cricket, never did anything beyond like base level education, and then you get them and then you've got to support them into doing something outside of cricket. So you've obviously got a background in education as well that we kind of haven't touched on. How do you, with those scenarios, and again, two very different examples there, you have a role to provide informed advice on those education and career choices. How do you consider the factors when you're talking about those educational pathways with the players?
I think it's different for every individual player, obviously, as you've mentioned there. But rightly or wrongly, for me, I don't want my philosophy is not to force anything onto a player. I think I would I know I would prefer to spend time with them in understanding, you know, who they are, what kind of life they would like to live, what interests them, what are their strengths, and we spend a lot of time in that sort of exploratory phase, because I've seen it so often where, you know, kids come out of year 11 and 12 and then there's pressure on them from parents to, you know, you can't just do cricket, you have to do something else, you've got to study. So they enroll in something that they think they might be interested in. They've done absolutely no exploration or investigating what it actually is. They end up 6 months in, hate it, and then they quit. So my philosophy is to spend a lot of time, yeah, in that exploration phase, understanding, helping them understand what it is they like, what it is they don't like, and just trying lots and lots and lots of different things. So, you know, it can be as small as listening to a podcast or doing lots of reading about things that you're interested in, meeting up with people that do things that you think you might want to do, do some work experience. And then we look at the sort of educational pathway that might take, because they're more likely to stick with it because, A, no one's told them that they have to do it. B, they've done some investigating and they know that they're interested and, you know, it's something that they want to do. And then, yeah, they have far more success if they take the time to understand what it is that they want to do. And I guess that approach is the same whether or not it's a kid from year 12 coming into a full-time program or a 35-year-old who was reluctant to try anything alongside cricket during their career and has left it all to the end. I guess the younger kids have got, you know, time on their hands, but again, cricket's so well resourced that for a retiring player, they have access to a retirement fund that will set them up for at least, yeah, well, depending on how much they've played, they've got sort of a 12-month period where they can take the time to figure it out. And it just becomes, it's more empowering, it's more meaningful, it's more purposeful, and it ends up just far more successful.
Emma, the last question that we ask everyone that comes on the podcast, if you could ask one coach, whether they're with us or passed on in any sport, who would the coach be and what would the question be?
Okay, now I've done my research on this. And it didn't actually take me long to come up with the coach. I know absolutely nothing about rugby, but I love Wayne Bennett. I've read his books, watched all the docos, like the Dolphins doco, and I think he's just an incredible human. So the question I would ask is, he's been in lots of different teams, in lots of different environments, and always been able to somehow have success. I'd just be dead keen to know what he puts that down to.
I think the book that Emma's referring to, I'm just looking over my shoulder, I can't see it to jump out. Is that The Wolf in Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a perception. Most people will know who Wayne Bennett is, but what most people won't know is the kind of story behind him. He has two kids that have severe physical disabilities as well, and there's two very different Wayne Bennett's, and that I've read that book as well, and it is a fascinating read, both from a understanding of coaching, but also just an understanding of, I guess, the separation that Wayne Bennett has between Wayne Bennett the coach and Wayne Bennett the person. And he also talks about some of the mistakes that he's made, because no one's perfect. So Emma, that's a fantastic answer, and feeds in well to giving our coaches something to go away and do some personal research on. Thank you so much for doing this. I know you are in a really busy period with the Shield final coming up and the girls' season just finishing. I think that is an incredible insight for our coaches, and will give them some things that they can go away and think about. So thank you so much, and good luck to the boys for the final coming up.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.